You are listening to World Radio, KHOE, 90.5 FM from the campus of Maharshi University of Management. And this is the program, A Chat with the Dean, with your host, Dr. Kathy Carini, Dean of Faculty here at Maharshi University of Management. Her guest today is Dr. Craig Pearson, Executive Vice President at Maharshi University of Management. And we will be talking about Dr. Pearson's new book, Experiences of Enlightenment Throughout Time, and how you can cultivate them. Kathy Carini, welcome to the program, and Dr. Craig Pearson, welcome.
Thank you. Craig, I've worked with you for many, many years, and you have been dean of students, you've been dean of faculty, you've taught writing, you've done so many different things at the university. What inspired you to write this book, The Supreme Awakening?
That is a good question. Ever since I encountered Maharshi's teaching, of all of the different branches of his teaching, all of the different dimensions of knowledge, the notion of higher states of consciousness has always been fascinating to me. I think any thinking person has the feeling that there must be more to life than they're living. And certainly, even in our ordinary waking experience, there's more to life. We have moments that are a little more peaceful or a little less peaceful or a little more happy or a little less happy. But the notion that there could be dimensions of consciousness, worlds of experience that are not just a little bit more, but quantum more, but also completely natural, that really, really appealed to me. That has fascinated me right from the beginning, and then also early on. And so with that fascination, I began to think, how can I share my enthusiasm with other people, share my appreciation, help other people see what a phenomenal idea this is, that there are the just quantum different and more natural and more full and more fulfilled and more blissful, more powerful modes of experiencing ourselves, modes of experiencing the environment. How can I communicate that to people? So that was a question for me. And then a final piece was early on I began to come across in my reading and in discussions with others little snippets of a poem here and there where somebody seemed like they were describing that. So that set me on a path of searching, like panning for gold and gathering these together. And I also discovered that other people resonated with these. So then the idea was born. Let's write a book about higher states of consciousness where we lay out systematically Maharshi's understanding of each of the higher states. And also, let's illustrate it with these magnificent descriptions from people through history. And so what I've collected in this book are the cream of the crop of supreme peak experiences, spiritual experiences, just the highest of the highest, from every tradition, from every historical epic, from all over the world, and shown that these are descriptions of higher states of consciousness exactly as Maharshi has described them.
And how did you find all these different people?
You do a lot of reading.
And then, you know, one thing leads to another, I suppose.
Yeah, there's some kind of networking through books and one thing. But like panning for gold, you know, you have to sift through a lot of gravel and occasionally you find a gold nugget. So, you know, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of books. But I sometimes have the feeling that these things were trying to find me also. It may sound funny. I remember one experience I had where I'm just sitting at home at night and there's a Land's End catalog. I pick it up and I'm browsing through it, and Land's End, at least they used to have this feature from time to time, they'd have this center feature article that they, in addition to selling their shirts and their stuff, and this one article was commissioned by Land's End. They sent a photographer and a writer to Mongolia, where that's where they get the cashmere wool for their sweaters. So they want their readers to know what's it like in Mongolia. So I'm reading this little thing in a Land's End catalog, and right in the middle of this writer's description, he describes this beautiful experience of unity consciousness in a Land's End catalog. You know, a glimpse, just a glimpse of it, a glimpse of the experience of one, of being a part of everything, of seeing oneself in everything. So you find them in unusual places sometimes.
A reminder to our KHOE listening audience that you are listening to the program A Chat with the Dean
with our Dean of Faculty, Dr. Kathy Guarini. She is interviewing Executive Vice President of Maharshi University of Management, Dr. Craig Pearson, whose new book, The Supreme Awakening, Experiences of Enlightenment Throughout Time and How You Can Activate Them, has just been released.
So, Craig, could you share some of your favorite, or maybe probably they're all favorite, but could you share some of these quotations with us?
Yeah, it's really hard to select, but I'll do my best here. So many of them are my favorites, and as I said, they come from all over the world, from as far back as Lao Tzu, 600 or 700 years B.C., and Plato, you know, 400 or 500 years B.C., all the way down through medieval Christian saints and medieval Sufi saints from the Muslim tradition, on down through our friends in the United States, Emerson and Whitman and Thoreau and Emily Dickinson, who were called the American Transcendentalists, not because of their transcendental philosophy so much, but because of their they actually had glimpses of the transcendent, and British poets, and on down to people who are still alive. Like,
yeah, I noticed you have some sports heroes.
Yeah, Billie Jean King, great tennis player. In her description of being out on the tennis court, her peak experience, you read it and you say, that's a glimpse of a higher state of consciousness. You know, that's not, and the thing is, people, although they've appreciated these experiences, in the case of Billie Jean King, they might say, well, that's a classic experience of the zone. Well, fine, but what does that mean? And now we have, from Maharshi, this idea that there are stages of human development that, just as we can demarcate stages of development when children grow older, you know, Piaget's stages and so on, now there are stages of human development beyond what we experience as the adult waking state, worlds of experience beyond that, completely natural, completely normal. All that's needed is proper cultivation of the physiology in the brain to experience it. And people have been glimpsing and describing these experiences throughout time because they're natural human experiences. In fact, this work that I've done, you could take it almost as a research hypothesis that Maharshi's put forward as a hypothesis that higher stages of human development exist, that they're universal. That universal means they're not dependent on culture or background, and that they exist and they're universal. So, okay, if that's the case, then we should be able to go back in history and find specimens of that, examples of that. So that's, in effect, what I've done. So then you come back from the records of history and bring this data, you know, let's call it data, supporting the hypothesis that higher states of consciousness are A, real, and B, universal. And then you add to that the experiences of people who practice transcendental meditation. They're not Wordsworth. They're not Plato. You know, you and I, we're not Thomas Traherne. We're not Einstein. But just ordinary people learn to meditate, and then they begin to describe in almost the same words often the same kind of experiences that you do read from Einstein or Wordsworth or Plato or Lao Tzu. Yeah.
Now, we have our own technique, transcendental meditation, and we do find that it leads us to higher states of consciousness. In all of your research, did you find any indications of any of these people suggesting to other people how they might gain higher states of consciousness?
I haven't. I mean, certainly in the Eastern tradition, there's a long, long tradition of technique. You know, in India, in China, and Japan. In the cases where people were describing their experience in writing or written down by other people later, there wasn't a technique associated with it. But you have to imagine that back in the early days, and even down through time, that there were techniques. And it's amazing, even in the Western tradition, when you think about what people have done, well, even around the world, let's say this, the whole notion of some kind of higher experience has been so charming that people have done unbelievable things. They walk away from home, walk away from family, walk away from possessions, go into a cave, go into the desert, go into a monastery or a nunnery or an ashram, fast, all sorts of mental disciplines, all sorts of forms of prayer, all sorts of readings, all sorts of physical demanding disciplines to try to do something to jar the physiology, jar the mind into having some kind of higher experience. And they've worked in some cases, more or less. So the idea of technique has been there for a long time, but I think it's been Marshy's genius to bring out a technique that's just effortless and simple.
And you don't have to. It works for everyone.
It works for everybody, and you don't have to leave the world. And also his emphasis that spiritual experience, enlightenment, higher states of consciousness are not just for a reclusive person. They're for everybody. And I think it's heartening to see so many people going into some sort of meditation practice today, because that means they realize, they think, they feel that there's some kind of higher experience available. And so maybe meditation or something is a way to get it. The interesting thing about the transcendental meditation technique, and especially with reference to these experiences that I've collected, is that the scientific research on transcendental meditation brings out the reality that higher states of consciousness are not just some new mood or philosophy that you've adopted or some new attitude or positive thinking. It's not that. It's not trying to be in the present like that, trying to make some effort. It really depends on systematic cultivation of integrated nervous system functioning to reach certain thresholds of integration at which the nervous system will support a new threshold of experience. So it really depends on cultivating the physiology. And then when you go through experiences like this, let me find this one here. I'll find this really quickly. People actually referring to physiological changes. The classic one that I open up the book with is William Wordsworth, where he's 28 years old. He's walking at the very southwest corner of England with his sister on one of the, he liked to go out walking for days at a time. He's walking up the Wye River Valley, and there's this beautiful abbey before him, now a ruin, you know, Tintern Abbey, this beautiful lattice work. And he sits down and, you know, closes his eyes as his sister walks on ahead, and he has an experience. And this is the experience that he just loves. And so many people are familiar with this, but
it
bears repeating, and it relates to the point I was just making, where Wordsworth describes, these are his words describing his experience. He describes that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. Okay, now Wordsworth is a poet, and he's using poetic language, but it's obvious he's trying his best to describe a unique experience as objectively as he can, even to the point of describing the changes in his physiological state, until the breath of this corporeal frame, that means his body, and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended. So we know from research on the transcendental meditation technique that at the deepest points of meditation, breath is literally suspended in a completely natural way. Nobody's trying to manipulate their breath or follow their breath or do anything with their breathing. It's just that as mental activity settles inward, physiological activity settles down, and the breath naturally becomes suspended. And that suspension of breath corresponds with the most integrated state of brain functioning.
Which he calls harmony.
He calls harmony. That's right. That's harmony. And there's a three-way correspondence. It also corresponds with what the meditating subjects report as their deepest points of transcending. They press a button, you know, during their meditation when they've come out. So we know about breath suspension, even the motion of our human blood. You know, we know that heart rate declines. We know that blood chemistry becomes transformed. Chemicals, biochemicals associated with stress and anxiety decline, while those associated with health and well-being, like serotonin, increase. So here's Wordsworth describing physiological changes. We're laid asleep in body, but we become a living soul. So Maharshi's phrase is restful alertness. Restful is the body, alertness is the mind. We're laid asleep in body, there's your restful. We become a living soul, there's the mind. We wake up inside. And that's a theme that we find repeated throughout so many of these, where people will talk about their experience in terms of waking up almost, and they'll say explicitly, it's like my normal waking consciousness was like I was sleeping compared to this heightened wakefulness that I'm experiencing now. And then when the experience fades, they say, well, now I'm just back to the dull, dreary ashes of this world, which is the world that we live in and we take to be the normal world, not knowing that our mind and body and our brain physiology and our nervous system have the capacity to support incredible, exalted, blissful, expanded, liberating experiences.
Yes, I like the illustrations given by some of the people you mentioned in here about how silence is not just silent, and it is silent. But when you appreciate everything associated with complete silence, and yet you're awake, is different.
That's right, and so many people from such different cultures, as I was saying earlier, will use similar language. Here's Helen Keller. I thought, now Helen Keller, I think everybody knows, from the age of 2 forward, she was blind and deaf. So that's from a ordinary experience level. That's like living in a prison, and you can't see, you can't hear. And I thought, somebody who must spend so much time inward, maybe she had some kind of experience. So I, through our library, through our interlibrary loan, I sent for all of Helen Keller's books. You know, I just, 7 or 8 of them. Beautiful books, just beautiful books. And read through them, just seeing what I could find. And here are a couple passages that I found from Helen Keller. She says, these are short, which is why I've chosen them also. I sense a holy passion pouring down from the springs of infinity. Bound to sun and planets by invisible cords, I feel the flame of eternity in my soul. Here in the midst of everyday air, I sense the rush of ethereal rains. I am conscious of the splendor that binds all things of earth to all things of heaven. Immured by silence and darkness, I possess the light which shall give me vision 1,000-fold when death sets me free. So, if you know what you're looking for, and you know, if you know what the characteristics of higher states of consciousness are, then you'll see a passage like this in a whole new light than if you don't. I think most readers reading this might think, that's a poetic flight of fancy, or she's imagining something, or it's wishful thinking, or she's imagining what it might be like to see. But she's not imagining at all. She's talking about, I feel the flame of eternity in my soul. I mean, that's the experience of transcending. When you transcend, the mind settles inward beyond thought, beyond perception, beyond space and time, to the transcendent. Beyond space and time means it's unbounded, it's eternal. The experience... That's what Wordsworth meant when he said, I see into the life of things. You know, the underlying life is just unbounded and eternal. So this is not any kind of metaphor that she's using. And then she, just to repeat, here in the midst of everyday air, so even, you know, in this ordinary waking state, I sense a rush of ethereal rain. So it's a little bit poetic, but we understand that she's describing, almost certainly describing, some glimpse of unboundedness deep inside. And here's just one other from Helen Keller. There is in the blind, as in the seeing, an absolute, capitalized absolute, which gives truth to what we know to be true, order to what is orderly, beauty to the beautiful, touchableness to what is tangible, reality, of which visible things are the symbol, shines before my mind. While I walk about my chamber with unsteady steps, my spirit sweeps skyward on eagle wings and looks out with unquenchable vision upon the world of eternal beauty. Well, you know, you can go back to, you know, Plato. I could go back and read some passages from Plato, which are just remarkably like that. So here's a woman who can't see with her eyes, but she has a capacity of experience inward, so refined that she can experience that, what she calls absolute, unchanging value of ourself deep inside. And this is a thread that runs through every religious tradition, every philosophical tradition, that it's even called the perennial philosophy, the primordial tradition. It's just a universal teaching that if you strip away, you know, all of the, you know, philosophies and doctrines and rituals and everything, and go to the core of any tradition, what you'll find is, you know, there's an inner value of life. The kingdom of God is inside you, and that is absolute and unbounded and blissful, and that's what people have glimpsed, and some people, you know, many people have become established at that level. Here's a little, just a little snippet from Albert Einstein, regarded by many as the greatest scientist who ever lived. Here's just a little touch on that same theme that we just heard from Helen Keller, where he writes in a letter, he's writing to Queen Elizabeth of Belgium, "Still there are moments when one feels free from one's own identification with human limitations and inadequacies. At such moments, one imagines that one stands on some small spot of a small planet, gazing in amazement at the cold yet profoundly moving beauty of the eternal, the unfathomable. Life and death flow into one, and there is neither evolution nor destiny, only being." Okay, so what are the key characteristics here? You're free from your own identification with human limitations and inadequacies. So that's transcending to a level that's beyond, you know, my small localized self, beyond space and time. And at that level, you know, what is there? Life and death flow into one because it's beyond change. There's neither evolution nor destiny. It's just beyond change. There's only being. And even Maharshi used that word being, pure being, to describe the field of pure existence, pure consciousness, the unified field, which underlies everything and which we can experience deep within.
Now, this sounds like a case of unity consciousness here.
Well, for those listeners who are familiar with the details of higher states, the transcendental experience, you know, when we sit with our eyes closed and mind settles inward, practice transcendental meditation, so simple and natural, mind spontaneously without any effort settles inward, and we just experience pure consciousness, our own unbounded self, just aware of itself alone, no thoughts, no perceptions, no memories, but we're not asleep, just pure wakefulness. That is a unity consciousness. I mean, that is an experience of unity. There's just oneness at that point. The thing is that when we open our eyes, then that experience, all that goes away. As we grow to higher states of consciousness, we begin to live that value of our transcendental, unbounded, unified self more and more in daily life, until finally in the highest stage, unity, we see that value in everything around us.
Well, you said maybe you had a few more to read.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. You can't read the whole book here, so there'll be some more for listeners to find.
Yeah. So far we've focused on the experience that we might call the meditative experience, transcendental experience, the experience with eyes closed. And early on in the research on transcendental meditation, scientists realized that that was a fourth major state of consciousness, distinct from waking and dreaming and sleeping. And why is that? Because uniquely in the fourth state, the body is experiencing extremely deep rest, which reminds us of sleep, but it's not, the mind isn't asleep. The mind is awake. In fact, the mind is more awake than in the ordinary waking state, because now the full depth of the mind is awake from the surface on down to our innermost depth. So that's a very distinctive fourth major state of consciousness. And as the research on the transcendental meditation unfolded over 30 or 40 years, that state now has been defined physiologically very precisely, you know, the breathing, the blood chemistry, and so on. But there's a fifth state, and that fifth state involves having the transcendental experience, the experience of unbounded awareness beyond space and time, even when we're wide awake. And that's what needs a highly cultivated brain physiology and nervous system, purified nervous system. So here's Billie Jean King, regarded by many as one of the greatest women athletes, one of the greatest athletes of all time, multiple Wimbledon championships. And here she is describing her experience on the tennis court. And this is a little bit longer, but I'll read it. On my very best days, I have this fantastic, utterly unselfconscious feeling of invincibility. I don't worry about how I'm hitting the ball, and I hardly notice my opponent at all. It's like I'm out there by myself. I concentrate only on the ball in relationship to the face of my racket, which is a full-time job anyway, since no two balls ever come over the net the same way. I appreciate what my opponent is doing, but in a very detached, abstract way, like an observer in the next room. I see her moving to her left and right, but it's almost as though there weren't any real opponent, as though I didn't know, and certainly didn't care, whom I was playing against. When I'm in that kind of state, I feel that tennis is an art form capable of moving both the players and the audience. When I'm performing at my absolute best, I think that some of the euphoria that I must be feeling must be transmitted to the audience. Okay, there the key phrase is, my opponent is, I experience her almost as though I'm an observer in the next room. And listeners who are familiar with this state, the fifth state of consciousness, which Marci calls cosmic consciousness, will recognize that that's a description of the experience that Marci calls witnessing. And Marci has a very precise definition for that. In this state, now our mind is completely established in that inner, unbounded reality beyond time and space. So the full depth of the mind is awake. And now we're identifying not with the surface wavy level of the mind, but with that innermost level, which is literally outside of time and space. So quite naturally, with our experience taking place from there, we would feel a natural sense of separation from everything that's going on around us, even a natural sense of separation from the activity of our own mind, which is all in the relative, completely natural. And it doesn't mean we're not effective, that separation, because Billie Jean King, this is her, when she's playing her best. And this is the classic zone experience where the athlete is feeling that everything is going just perfectly. This is peak performance. But at the same time, I'm not doing anything. I'm transcendent to all of this. I'm just watching it all happen. And yet I'm performing at my peak. And on top of that, I'm feeling more blissful than I've ever felt in my whole life. Those are the three qualities of the peak experience, of the zone experience. Peak performance, I'm not doing anything. It's all effortless. And I am just euphoria. Now, let me read on from Billie Jean King, because she develops this idea in more detail in this next passage. And if you listen carefully, you'll notice that she uses the word perfect here seven times, which says something about the state she's describing. The perfect shot is another matter. They don't come along very often, and when they do, they're great. It gives me a marvelous feeling of almost perfect joy, especially if I can pull one off on the last shot of the match. I can almost feel it coming. It usually happens on one of those days when everything is just right, when the crowd is large and enthusiastic, and my concentration is so perfect, it almost seems as though I'm able to transport myself beyond the turmoil on the court to some place of total peace and calm. I know where the ball is going to be on every shot, and it always looks as big and well-defined as a basketball, just a huge thing that I couldn't miss if I wanted to. I've got perfect control of the match. My rhythm and movements are excellent, and everything's just in total balance. That perfect moment happens in all sports. It's a perfect combination of a violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility. My heart pounds, my eyes get damp, and my ears feel like they're wiggling, but it's also just totally peaceful. And when it happens, I want to stop the match and grab the microphone and shout, "That's what it's all about," because it is. It's not the big prize I'm going to win at the end of the match or anything else. It's just having done something that's totally pure and having experienced the perfect emotion, and I'm always sad that I can't communicate that feeling right at the moment it's happening. I can only hope the people realize what's going on. Okay, this sounds like a pretty amazing experience that she has, you know, for parts of a game. But when you look at some of the key phrases in here, you know, perfect mind-body coordination. Now, let's remember the mind is fully awake at this point. Not just the surface of the mind is awake. The mind is fully awake. And when that happens, mind and body come into perfect coordination. That's where the peak performance comes from, where she talks about perfect control of the rat's rhythm and movements are excellent. Everything's just in total balance. But then the key phrase is, it's the perfect combination of violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility. And that defines cosmic consciousness, where in the midst of all of the dynamic activity of the world, and we're doing everything we do, but deep inside, it is total tranquility. It's absolute serenity. Unshakable, untouchable. The greatest joy, the deepest sorrow, never touches that innermost reality of serenity and bliss. And that, it seems to me, is what she's describing here.
Why does that remind me of when I used to teach TM?
Yeah.
The same thing. You feel like everything was just perfect.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and the feeling was perfect at the end. Everything was just the way it should have been.
Here again, she emphasizes, my heart pounds, my eyes get damp, my ears feel like they're wiggling, but it's also just totally peaceful. So in this fifth state, cosmic consciousness, it's the coexistence of dynamic activity with the inner transcendental state. So when we experience that inner transcendence, when we transcend regularly through our TM practice, then gradually, steadily, if we're patient, that value grows day by day in our life. The mind becomes more and more infused with that unbounded transcendental reality. The nervous system and the brain become more and more purified and integrated and able to maintain and support that experience until it becomes a 24/7 reality. It's not that when we open our eyes, it's gone. It's just more there day by day. And that's growing in our life day by day. It's not some distant future. It's like turning on a rheostat, you know, that just that inner light of life just becomes brighter day by day. But we do reach the point where it's that unbroken continuum of wholeness of consciousness throughout our waking experience.
Now, you've divided this up according to the different states of consciousness.
Right.
When you were reading what people wrote, did you find it clear that they were talking about one or another, or did you find that sometimes they mixed these things up, or maybe they were finding states of consciousness we don't know about?
Well, to me it was usually pretty clear what state they were describing. There were a few where they're describing two at once, and that's when higher states of consciousness grow, we don't leave something behind. You know, like when we experience in the fourth state transcendental consciousness, then when we grow to the fifth state, cosmic consciousness, we don't lose that. That's what we were just saying. We maintain that all the time.
Right, but we can still experience, you know, we'll be in cosmic consciousness, waking, and transcendental consciousness, and then the waking can go away, so we can experience the...
Yeah, we can close our eyes and just experience pure transcendence.
Right.
Then we riot when we go to higher states of consciousness still, like, say, the sixth state of consciousness, wherein now in the fifth state, once the mind is completely unbounded, once the nervous system is purified of stress, then the senses of perception embark on this amazing process of refinement, leading us to the direct perceptual, through our physical senses of perception, increasingly refined values of the world around us until we can experience the very subtlest, most refined, most rarefied stratum of creation. And that most rarefied stratum of creation is there around us all the time. We just don't have sufficiently refined senses to perceive it. It's as though, you know, we're colorblind. It's not that color has gone away. The color is out there in the world. But if we somehow were to gain the facility of appreciating the color, then whoa, Now here's where did all of this new dimension of experience come from? So this perceptual experience of the very finest relative value of nature is just so far beyond the shift from, like, you know, black and white to color, just completely beyond words. But let me read you a passage that illustrates that. So this is Rabindranath Tagore, who was the first non-European to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was Indian, tremendous, prodigious literary output, also well-known as a painter, also a musical composer. We don't think of him as a composer, but he has the unique distinction of being the only person ever to write the national anthems for two countries, India and Bangladesh. But it's for his literature that he's known and celebrated. And here he describes an experience that just he happened innocently, just spontaneously. He was visiting his brother in Calcutta, which even back in the early 1900s must have been a very busy, crowded city. So he steps out on the veranda or porch, and here's what happens to him. He says, "Where the Sadar Street ends, trees in the garden of Free School Street are visible. One morning I was standing in the veranda looking at them. The sun was slowly rising above the screen of their leaves, and as I was watching it, suddenly, in a moment, a veil seemed to be lifted from my eyes. I found the world wrapped in an inexpressible glory, with its waves of joy and beauty bursting and breaking on all sides. The thick shroud of sorrow that lay on my heart in many folds was pierced through and through by the light of the world, which was everywhere radiant. That very day, the poem, known as The Fountain Awakened from Its Dream, flowed on like a fountain itself. When it was finished, still the curtain did not fall on that strange vision of beauty and joy. There was nothing and no one whom I did not love at that moment. I stood on the veranda and watched the coolies as they tramped down the road. Their movements, their forms, their countenances seemed strangely wonderful to me, as if they were all moving like waves in the great ocean of the world. When one young man placed his hand upon the shoulder of another and passed laughingly by, it was a remarkable event to me. I seemed to witness in the wholeness of my vision the movements of the body of all humanity and to feel the beat of the music and the rhythm of the mystic dance. For some days I was in this ecstatic mood. My brothers had made up their minds to go to Darjeeling, and I accompanied them. I thought I might have a fuller vision of what I had witnessed in the crowded parts of the Sadar Street if once I reached the heights of the Himalayas. But when I reached the Himalayas, the vision all departed. That was my mistake. I thought I could get at truth from the outside. But however lofting and imposing the Himalayas might be, they could not put anything real into my hands. But God, the great giver, himself can open the whole universe to our gaze in the narrow space of a single lane." Now, that is just an incredible experience. And the phrases that jump out here are where he talks about looking out at the veil lifted from his eyes. That's an image that so many people use when suddenly for a moment their senses of perception begin to function in this more refined way, and they see through to this more subtle reality. And they say it's like a veil is lifted. And then what does he say? He says, "I found the world wrapped in inexpressible glory with its waves of joy and beauty bursting and breaking on all sides." And then he says that the thick shroud of sorrow that lay in my heart in many folds was pierced through and through by the light of the world, which was everywhere radiant. So this is another common theme, that refined value, the very finest relative value, what is it? It's just shining, radiant, divine light, as though everything is shining with a halo. And that's there. That's for us to experience. We just need to, and what a world that would be. It's around us all the time. We just need to cultivate our physiology so that the senses can perceive what's already there. Right now, our senses see what they see, but it's pretty crude functioning. You know, our senses are good enough to tell that one thing is different from another, to see the outer boundaries, like the outer husks of things. But this inner reality is what people glimpse, and it's just so delicious and inviting.
You have been listening here on KHOE to an interview by Dr. Kathy Guarini with Executive Vice President of Maharshi University of Management, Dr. Craig Pearson, whose new book, The Supreme Awakening, Experiences of Enlightenment Throughout Time and How You Can Activate Them, has just been released.
I know this is less significant than everything else, but I notice for these people, you all have pictures. Now, how did you find pictures of all these people? This is what.
Well, there's a story behind every one of these. This was a huge amount of research, not just to find the texts that I've reprinted here, but even to find the pictures in some case. Many of the pictures are just available online, but I did have to be careful to respect copyright and so on, get permission in many cases.
But it
to
makes
find the
it
pictures.
So much more real that there's some suggestion of who the person might be.
That's what I thought, that when if people could see the faces of the people that they're hearing the experiences from, that it just makes it more personal and real. Let me read one more. We've talked about a fourth state of consciousness, which is the meditative state, the transcendental state, eyes closed, just experiencing my own unbounded, transcendental, immortal self, just so blissful, so creative. That's the fourth state. The fifth state of consciousness, which I didn't mention, also has its very distinct physiological characteristics, nervous system purified of stress, the brain functioning in a completely integrated way. That's the experience of the transcendental unbounded self along with our ordinary daily experience, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. From Rabindranath Tagore, we just had a glimpse of the sixth state of consciousness, which Maharshi calls God consciousness, so named because we appreciate the full glory of God's creation, even there at the end. Tagore talked about how, you know, he even made an allusion to God. God gives the experience of, you know, the whole universe in the narrow space of a single lane. But even beyond those glorious experiences, there's one final state, the seventh state, which Maharshi calls unity consciousness, where more than just seeing the very finest relative values of the world around us, we actually see the underlying transcendental value that's beyond space and time, that everything is made out of that. And what is that underlying transcendental value? It's the same underlying transcendental value that we first experienced way back when we transcended during transcendental meditation and experienced ourselves as unbounded. Now we see that that's the basis of everything, and when we look at the world, hear the world, touch the world around us, it's our direct immediate experience that we're hearing or seeing or touching nothing other than ourself. It doesn't mean that the world turns into some kind of soup. All of the all of the distinctions, the left and right and hot and cold, they're all still there. But dominating our experience is the bliss of our own self and everything. So this is an experience that I just stumbled across. I was reading a book. I like to read books on brain science and keep up with what's going on in that field. So I was reading a book by an English medical writer named Rita Carter, award-winning writer. And right in the middle of this book, where she's summarizing research, she shifts gears and talks about a personal experience. And this personal experience happened to her in northwest England, around Manchester, in January. It's a freezing night. She's driving around parts of England, meeting with people, interviewing them for her next book. So now she's in Manchester. It's a freezing night. It's pouring down hail. It's late at night, and her car breaks down. Okay, so then it takes a while for some mechanic to come, and by the time he fixes the problem, it's 3:00 in the morning, it's still hailing, she's soaked, what to do? And the mechanic says, well, I have an aunt, you know, who lives in the neighborhood, she has an extra room, I'll take you there, we'll wake her up, you know, she'll take you in. So they knock on the door, and the aunt comes and brings Rita Carter in, and takes her wet clothes, makes sure she has a hot bath. So now Rita Carter climbs into bed, and here's what she describes. When I noted the fire, one of those built-in gas burners was still on, I thought I should probably get out of bed and switch it off. But as I looked at it, something very strange happened. I realized that I was not only looking at it from the perspective of where I lay, but, weird as this may sound, I was seeing it, too, from within the flame itself. I was the fire, absorbed in its redness and warmth, both giving and receiving its heat. At the same time, this was not a sequential realization, I became aware that I was also the bed, and the walls, and the window, and the sheets. Myself seemed to have bled out of its boundary and infiltrated every crevice of the room. Stranger yet, I was not just in the room, but beyond it, too. Although I could not literally see out beyond its four walls, I seemed to be outside them as well as within. Indeed, I felt that I was everywhere and everything, embracing the most distant stars, yet also inhabiting the smallest speck of dust. All sense of space, location, boundedness, and division disappeared. As all this happened, I thought, or rather I knew, that what I was experiencing was the real state of things, that I was part of a much greater whole, and that all my experience up until now had been, in some sense, unreal. Despite its peculiar nature, I felt no anxiety and, odder, no curiosity. It all felt entirely natural. I have no idea how long the feeling lasted. At some stage, I lay down and slept. In the morning, the fire, still burning, was back in its appointed location, and so was I. Yet, unlike a dream, the experience remained crystal clear and as real and significant as it had been while it happened. So this is certainly, you know, a different world of experience, and it doesn't replace, she makes clear that she can still discern the differences among things. They don't all in some way meld together, but she feels that they're all, you know, she is that, and that's her, and it's all part of herself, and that self is a grand wholeness that dwells within the farthest reaches of space, but also the tiniest speck of dust, so larger than the largest and smaller than the smallest. And the whole thing is completely natural. And so this is the kind of experience that we are born as human beings to enjoy, not just as fleeting moments, or even as fleeting moments that we read about in a book and admire and enjoy, but that we grow and cultivate. And, you know, these are the kind of experiences that are coming out of the Invincible America mm-hmm. Assembly that, you know, are shared on so many mornings, you know, experiences at this level of unity. And again, it comes down to just systematically, properly, fully cultivating the potentials of our, you know, of our brain, of our nervous system and our body.
Yeah, I would think that of this as a companion volume to the experience yeah. volume.
Yeah. So these are the kinds of the experiences that I've shared here are more modern. I mean, well, Wordsworth is a few hundred years old, but Einstein and Rabindranath Tagore is just the last century, and Rita Carter is still with us. But these kinds of experiences, you can find them often in strikingly similar language in Lao Tzu in China, 7 centuries BC. Now, what was life like in China 26 or 2700 years ago? Probably quite different. And yet, it's a testimony to the reality of these kinds of experiences and their universality that people describe them in such similar languages. So ancient China, Plato, 400 or 500 years BC, you know, Jesus describes all four higher states in, you know, short snippets because he didn't elaborate on the experience. But again, if you know what you're looking for, you can see descriptions of all four higher states in his teaching. The Buddha, Shankara, these great spiritual leaders, on down to, as we've said, athletes and writers and explorers and scientists. And in my experience, these sorts of accounts are exceedingly rare, like, as I said, panning for gold, and yet they're all over the place. So now's the time for them to not be so rare anymore. And now's the time when more and more people are just experiencing them so readily through their TM practice, even spontaneously.
Well, this has been really, really inspiring. Thank you so much for sharing this with you and with us. And I know this is available at the Golden Dome Market and the MUM store.
Available online at mumpress.com, uh-huh. mumpress.com. And I think it makes clear, let me just say this in closing, that when you look into every, you know, great spiritual tradition or philosophical tradition, when you peel away all of the paraphernalia, you come down to, at their core, what some people have described as the perennial philosophy, mm-hmm. or some have called it the primordial tradition. And the basic tenets of that primordial tradition or perennial philosophy are four. Number one, that underlying this world of diversity, this universe of diversity, there's an underlying unity, an ocean of unity. That's number one. Number two, we can experience that unity directly, not as an intellectual idea, but as a direct experience. And where? Deep within. So number two, we can experience it. Number three, when we have that experience, it transforms our life, just transforms it beyond our wildest imaginings. That's principle three. And the principle four is, we were born for that experience and that transformation. The whole purpose of our life is to have that experience and to be transformed by it. And what I've just enumerated are the fundamental principles of Maharshi's teaching. The Maharshi Vedic science, underlying unity, we can experience it, it transforms us, and that's the purpose of our life. That's our birthright, as Maharshi describes it. So Maharshi would so often say, you know, what I'm teaching is nothing new. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. But what he did, revive, first of all, was a technique so that we could have these experiences, cultivate the physiology to support them in an effortless way. So that he brought to light. And then secondly, a framework of human development so we can really understand what these experiences are. We experience them not just as mystical experiences and then we shove them off to the side and don't think about them anymore, but experiences that represent glimpses of higher human development, higher stages of human development that are everyone's birthright. So that's a great thing that Maharshi's brought to us. And that's what we offer here in our education at MUM, and is becoming increasingly available all over the world.
Thank you, Craig. This wonderful adventure to talk to not only the author, but to have him read some of his things, and it was just marvelous. Thank you so much. And this sort of reminds us, stay rested and do your program, group program, very important. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening to KHOE 90.5 FM. To be close to you.
fortunate is the seat you have taken. How fortunate indeed is the flower in your hand. How fortunate is the garland around you. To be close to you. To be close to you. To be part of you. To be